You're listening to KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And this is Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LP. I just said that. So anyways, we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And my co-host this evening is Katie O'Brien, and our guest is Ralph Epperson. And let me say, the views expressed on this program are those of myself and of my friends and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. Ralph is an historian, author, lecturer, who has been researching conspiratorial view of history, the view that the major events of the past have been planned years in advance by a central conspiracy for 40 years. He has written and produced four best-selling books entitled The Unseen Hand, The New World Order, Masonry, Conspiracy Against Christianity, Jesse James, United States Senator, and 9 booklets and 12 videos and 2 DVDs. And he's a graduate of the University of Arizona, but freely admits that what he has learned since graduation has taught him that most of what he had learned in college in history and political science simply was not true. He proudly states that his research has proven to him that there has been an active conspiracy in the world planning major wars, depressions, and inflations years in advance. Okay, Ralph, do you have anything more to add to that?
No, that's fine. No, that's a good beginning. It's something that I've been doing for 40-some years, and I'm quite convinced that I'm right. I keep finding new things that further confirm what I've been discussing, you know, and developing for years. So I'm firmly convinced that there's something going on in this country, and we're starting to see it more and more now than I think we ever have.
Right, and I mean, I was looking back at the back of your book, The Unseen Hand. I mean, you got quite a bibliography back there, so obviously you've been doing this a while.
I started reading in 1962 at the request of a friend of mine. Well, he wasn't a friend at the time. I didn't know him, but we became good friends. Another college graduate, but from California. And he said, I needed to study revisionist history. And I said, I don't know what that is. He said, that's my point. I said, are you telling me that history needs to be revised? And so I started reading in about 1962, and I'm still reading, although not as much as I was used to. I've read over 1,000 books, titles I call them, because some of them are small, but I've been reading and I'm still reading, but all of that reading on both sides of the issue has convinced me that there's something seriously going on in this nation, and we're starting to see the fruition of all of their plans in America for over 200 years. Right now, it's happening in far more rapid succession than anything I'd ever expected.
And who are they?
Well, that's the toughest part of the question. Let's define the word conspiracy. And Webster's defines it as two or more people meeting in secret with an evil purpose. Now, the reason they meet in secret is because they have an evil purpose. And they only let certain information out. You have to dig to find it. In fact, I've been doing that for 40 years, trying to find it, the information that they have released, because they let us know enough to know there's something going on, but generally we're convinced that it's hopeless or we can't do anything about it, and I'm trying to say we have to do something about it because the future they have for us is not very pleasant. We can start to name some of the people down at the lower levels, but this conspiracy is like that pyramid on the back of our dollar bill. It's at the bottom, there's many organizations, but as you go up higher and higher, there's less and less. And we're trying to find out some of the layers above the ones that we're supposed to know about. And that's the difficult part, because as a conspiracy, they've got to keep it secret. But I think we know enough to know there's something going on.
And give us a definition of what you see going on.
Well, we're going someplace, and where we're going is revealed on the back of our dollar bill. And those two circles are called the Great Seal of the United States, and First of all, a seal only has one side. Originally, it was the king would take a document or a treaty or a letter, whatever it is, and pour melted wax on it on the fold to hold it together, and then he would stick his ring in it to convince whoever got the paper that it was the king that had done this, because only he had the ring. If the seal had been broken and someone tried to put it back together, they'd have to melt the wax, and once they did that, they would obliterate or at least weaken the seal. So that's what a seal was. It was to give the document official recognition.
Ralph, just a second. When you talk, can you just back off just a little bit from your mouthpiece?
A little bit further. Okay, fine.
Okay.
Now, we have two sides to the seal, and the second seal reveals our future. And that's the pyramid side. Is that better with the voice?
Just a little bit more.
A little bit more, okay. So in other words, the second seal reveals where we're going, and it's very simple. We need to study that. And if we take the Latin words annuit coeptus or septus and novus ordo seclorum and translate them, we get announcing the birth of or the conception of novus new ordo order seclorum world, announcing the birth of the new world order. Now, these seals were adopted unanimously in 1782 by our founding fathers. So they knew where we were going, and they knew that we had a couple of hundred years to develop the techniques and the procedures that they would give us this new world order. And that's where we're going. And the new world order is a new civilization, completely changing the way we live our lives. And we'll discuss that at the very end, if you'd like. I'll give you evidence that that statement's true.
Now, when the interesting part about when you're saying this New World Order, whatever, isn't that kind of deceiving in its own right? Isn't that really going back to an old world order?
Well, you could argue that it's the Babylon, the ancient mystery religion, and that's what I've done in my second and third books. So it is, but it's never really been total or worldwide. It's always been, you'll notice civilizations all around the world all have families. And traditionally, the mother, the husband and wife have their children and they raise them. And that was done by design. Most every society in the world punishes thievery, stealing. They punish adultery. I just came from Tombstone a couple of weekends ago and there was a picture taken by the photographer in Tombstone, and it's a picture of an Indian woman, an Apache woman, with her nose cut off. And the caption underneath the picture says it was of a woman who committed adultery. And this was when there were no missionaries in the Apache community. So where did they get this idea of adultery? Where did they get the idea of marriage, the sanctity of marriage? Where did they get the idea of raising a family? So it's not old. We've traditionally for 6,000 years lived in families, children being raised by the parents, in a society that punishes murder and stealing and rape, you name it. And most societies do that. So we're going to change that. We're going to do away with all that, and that's what we can discuss a little further. What is this thing called the New World Order?
Well, tell us, what is this new thing called the New World Order?
Well, we could start there if you wanted to.
Yeah, why don't we?
I wasn't prepared for that at the beginning, but I've got a quote that we need to read. I'll see if I can find it. I've got some notebooks here, because I want to read it specifically with someone that knows. I don't know. Wait, maybe. No, I don't think I've got it here. Well, I'll have to do it from memory. There was a man by the name of Alvin Toffler who, according to the book The Third Wave, written in 1980, defines where we're going. And according to the book, he's a futurist and a social engineer, meaning he knows, I believe, where we're going because he puts it in writing in his book called The Third Wave. And it says that his books are read in 50 nations around the world, which means that if that's true, and I presume it is, the publisher put it out, If that's true, his ideas are circulating because he's convincing other nations that we're going to this thing called the New World Order. Now, he doesn't call it that, but what is it? He talks about the fact that these things that are happening, especially in the United States, are not happening by happenstance. They're happening by design. It's part of a plan. Well, what is he talking about? Changed ways of working. Notice that we're losing trade unions, huge industrial elements that we had in our nation. That's all been shipped out of the United States. I was in Pittsburgh several years ago riding around, and we saw all the steel mills that had been shut down. We're becoming a service-oriented nation. We're importing many of our basic ingredients. Changed ways of living, which means we're now legalizing homosexual and lesbian marriages. We're now calling them family. The word family was always defined as husband and wife and children if they have them. But a marriage was considered to be the coming together of a husband and wife in front of the family and the neighbors and in front of a minister ordained by God to become one. And then they would raise their children, and children would go on, and then when they get the parents get old, the children would take care of them. And so they were changing that today. More and more people are living together instead of getting married, which is not traditional in the United States.
Okay, but are you saying this was by design, though, too?
Yes,
okay.
All of this.
All right.
Because the New World Order is going to abolish the family. Well, that's impossible. No, it's not. It's happening right in front of us. That was the point that Mr. Toffer made.
Well, the communal society that kind of was around in the 60s.
We're going to end up that way. The New World Order, by the way, is already in place in China and the communes. Now, the rest of the Chinese don't live that way, but the communes do. And that's the New World Order. There is no family anymore. Now, wait a minute. The Chinese have had families for 10,000 years, whatever it is. And they've had the family raising the children themselves. But that's not the case anymore. We have, you're permitted to get married, and I'll explain why in a minute. But all the married men live together in a barracks. All the married women live together. And you're allowed to be with your wife on Saturday mornings between 9 and noon. And every morning, the women line up and take birth control pills. And then during the meetings they'd have at night, when they gather around together to discuss the joys of communism, I guess, they decide the society decides how many children to have. And then they give those couples permission to no longer take the birth control pills, and they produce the baby. But as soon as the baby is born, it's taken away. There's no more family, but China's had families for centuries. But this is where we're going. This is going to happen in America because it's the New World Order. There is no house on the hill anymore. We all live in barracks and communal buildings.
So is this what you think these FEMA camps and that sort of thing that they're building is about?
I'm not convinced that the FEMA camps are real, so I'm not one to really talk about that. I've heard stories about them, and I've never seen one. I've got pictures of 4 FEMA camps in my files, none of which is a FEMA camp. So I just,
okay.
I leave it alone. I don't know how they're going to do it. I'm just telling you, that's where we're going. Toffer made that point. These things are not happening by chance or happenstance. They're happening by design. That statement is true, and it's happening right in front of our eyes. But we don't understand.
And is Toffler one of the insiders, one of these?
Well, ma'am, I can't say. All I can say is what he wrote. You know, I don't know how much he knows, but I'll say someone told him about this because he put it in writing. He knows. It was written in 1980.
Okay, and when he refers to the third wave, what does that mean?
Well, he was talking about the first wave, I guess, was agriculture, and then the second great wave was the Industrial Revolution, and the third wave is going to be it's going to be all agriculture. In fact, in the communes, there's no private property. There's nothing except the commune and the agriculture.
Now, do you know how that came about in China, how this all evolved into this?
That's a tragic story as well, because it was our government that did it. It's an interesting story. Chiang Kai-shek was elected. Well, let's go back to Sun Yat-sen, who was the Chinese ruler. And he sent Chiang Kai-shek to Moscow to become a Marxist communist, to be trained as a communist. And Chiang Kai-shek came back to China, convinced that communism was the way of the future. But Chiang Kai-shek made a fatal mistake. Chiang Kai-shek fell in love with a woman by the name of Mei Ling Soon, and she was the daughter of a Chinese Christian missionary. And in Chiang Kai-shek's own writings, he talked about how he was impressed with these Christians. They were something new to him, because he was a Buddhist. And he said he was so impressed with the religion and the quality of people that the Christianity turned out, he became a Christian. As soon as he did, the Chinese Communist Revolution started. They had to replace him. He was actually elected, not by a popular vote, but by delegates selected from committees and organizations and unions and everything else. So Chiang Kai-shek was the first Chinese leader ever elected, but it doesn't matter to the communists. The communists came in, Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Tse-tung, and started a revolution in the northern provinces, and then the United States government took the army away from Chiang Kai-shek so that the communists would win. This is all covered in The Unseen Hand. We wanted that nation to go communist, and we made sure it happened. And Chiang Kai-shek ended up in Taiwan, as you know, and that government is far better and more prosperous and everything else than the whole mainland of China, because they believe in the free enterprise system and a constitution and a republican form of government. So our government did what it could to communize China, and so the communes are the result of Mao Tse-tung and Chiang Kai-shek, supported by the United States government. Now, we wanted them to go communist, and when Russia came down, when the Iron Curtain came down, China staged the Tiananmen Square thing to convince the world that freedom was dead in that nation and that they were not coming out of communism, they were staying. And Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw and Peter Jennings were all there to cover it, which means they were announcing to the world, and the American media was telling us through our representatives in the major media here in America, that China was not going to go free. There were statues of liberty made by these students, but here's the point. Those students were students in government-run schools. So that means that the government wanted them to do what they did, and then they shot them and killed them and ran over them with tanks to show that there's not going to be any freedom in this nation. We're communists.
So, okay, Katie, do you have any questions?
Well, sure. How long did it take to form these communes? I mean, how many years has this been
going
on? Well,
the revolution started in about 1923 and went to, I think, 1949. So it started right after that. By the way, this revolution killed 80 million Chinese. That's at least 1 in 10. 80 million Chinese died in this revolution, supported by the United States government. It's all covered, detailed with the documentation to show you what I'm telling you is true. Our government wanted China to go communist, and we did what we could to disarm Chiang Kai-shek and his successful army and to make sure the nation went communist.
Okay, and Ralph, I'm going to ask you to back up a little again, because when you get to your parts where you really have a lot of passion, kind of over-modulating there. So do you think that, then you're saying the New World Order is just being, is the same thing being put in here that they're putting in China, and
yes.
So ultimately, it isn't a new thing at all, is it?
No.
Okay.
The American people are going to lose their family, their right to private property, their right to worship a god, their right to worship or not worship a god. That's going to be eliminated. There will be no religion, no ministers, no priests, no rabbis, no missionaries, none. They are not allowed on the communes. There is no god. The first thing, there was a report of a lady who was probably, you know, testified like maybe in the 50s or 60s. A Chinese citizen, a woman, escaped the communes and came to America and testified before some Senate committee. And she said, it's interesting, the very first night when we were on the commune, when the communists took over, the first thing we talked about was evolution. Not Marxist communism, but evolution. And I said, boy, that was strange. Well, that's to convince us that there is no God, there is no religion, there's nothing except mind and matter, and we're all animals, and so we're going to live like animals in the commune. The animals don't have private property. They don't have TV sets. They don't have VCRs and boats and yachts and houses. So I'm telling you, it was all, as Mr. Toffler points out, it was all by design.
And that was written in 1980?
The Third Wave book was written in 1980, that's correct. Our founding fathers knew this, by the way. That's what we're going to talk about. Their founding fathers knew what this New World Order was. They encrypted it inside the Great Seal of the United States, announcing the birth of, or the conception of, the New World Order in 1787. That was before this first, they had our revolution in 1776. That was even before the government was created in 1789. So this was official. This was the government telling you in concealed, secret ways that we're going someplace. This nation is dedicated to delivering the New World Order. Notice, if it's the announcing the birth of or the conception of, it's still a baby. And the proof of that is that the eye above the pyramid is not on the pyramid, on the back of our dollar bill.
And explain
when
that.
When that eye lands, then the New World Order will start.
Okay, now how is that the proof of it? Explain that
a
little bit.
Well, it's all I can tell you is that's the way it was designed. It was designed to say that. Understand this. They've never put out the truth. You have to dig to find it. And then they say, well, wait, where'd you get that from? And that's the problem. We have done this from a variety of different sources to confirm that there's something going on. They've not told us this. If you go to the government to get an explanation of the Great Seal, they lie to us. They tell us that the Latin phrases means, annu acceptus means, he has looked with favor upon our undertaking. Well, what has that got to do with anything? Annuit, announcing, Latin for announcing or the announcement of, acceptus or coeptus, the conception of, the birth of, announcing the birth of, Novos, new, ordo, order, seclorum, world. Look up the word secular in your dictionary, and it comes from the Latin word seclorum, secularis. It's all the root word, which means world, a worldview, second definition, a worldview of man without a God.
But the first definition would be, is the state of being separate from, when used as an adjective.
Well, I'm trying to point out to you that we're going someplace and it's happening right in front of us. The New World Order, I've got a book by that title called The New World Order that shows you step by step what it means in their own writings. I have to piece it together, but they've made it. The Masons have been very heavily involved in this nation, and they tell you in their writings, if you reflect my brother, you will no doubt suspect that some secret teaching was contained in these words. That's about the Masonic ritual, but it's also about our future. If you took that dollar bill out on the street and asked 100 people, tell me all that you know about the Great Seal of the United States, what kind of response would you get? You'd say, I don't have any idea. I've never heard. No one's ever told me what it is. Well, I dug it out, and I can tell you what it means.
So if you're saying just on the dollar bill we have that much symbolism that we don't recognize or understand where it's coming from, imagine on our monuments and buildings what's being said there that we have no clue about.
Yes, ma'am. I agree. There's all sorts of videos coming out now showing you about the secret, occult, hidden, concealed symbolism all over Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. was created by by Congress to become the seat of the government of the United States, and we'll explain that a little bit later, maybe, if we get into the Constitution. And it's 10 miles square, and it's full of Masonic symbolism. I've been on the History Channel twice talking about this very same evidence, that we know what those symbols mean. We know who designed it, which Mason designed it. We know about George Washington being a member of the Masonic Lodge, and we know about the presidents who have been Masons. All of this is evidence that we can find and document.
It isn't just Washington, D.C., though. There's a lot of our capitals, like you'll see them in many of the towns. Memphis is full of a lot. I believe just about any of the state capitals has a fair amount of it, correct?
If I remember, Melody, help me with this, your state seal has an all-seeing eye on top, inside your state seal, the seal of Colorado.
Yes, I believe it does.
And there's also a fasci, which is the symbol of the fascist party in Italy. What's that got to do with the Americanism? We're supposed to be a republic. We're not supposed to be a fascist oligarchy or anything else. We're supposed to be a constitutional republic.
Yeah, but wasn't that seal there before Italy became fascist?
Oh, yes, I'm sure it did. Okay. But it's supposed to represent... In Washington, in the Capitol building, there's a symbol of the fasci on the back wall, and it's a bundle of sticks bound together, and I think there's even an axe head on it. So it's supposed to be one out of many, meaning you put a lot. One stick you can break, 10 sticks you maybe can break, but not 50. That's what it's supposed to be.
Okay.
So one out of it's a beautiful thought, except it's the symbol of the fascist, later became the symbol of the fascist party in Mussolini in Italy. See, this is the thing. Once you start to see this, it's everywhere. Symbolism is everywhere. Obelisks, squares and compasses, circles, buildings are built in a certain way. The numbers are everywhere. The numbers 13, 32, and 33 are all over the back of the dollar bill. I've got on my video called America's Secret Destiny. I show you as many of them as I could find to show you that whole dollar bill is a cult symbolism of the Masonic Lodge. They are the ones who designed this nation, and they designed it to fail. That's what I want to talk about when we get a chance.
Okay, go ahead.
Are you ready for that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're ready.
Okay. I want to, if I may, invite your listeners to get a copy of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, if they can get one real quick. If not, make some notes and then get a copy and read this to confirm it, that what I'm about to reveal to you is legitimate. I want to start with the Declaration of Independence. And that was issued on July the 4th, 1776, as everyone should know, at least. And down at the second paragraph, we're going to read two sentences down the bottom. The history of the present king of Great Britain, that's King George, is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations. Usurpations are violations of our rights, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. Notice, what does the word tyranny mean? Total government. That's it. Unlimited power in the government. They went on to say this was an absolute tyranny. There's no limit to the power. None. No Magna Carta, no Bill of Rights, no Constitution. That is the reason we were breaking from England. It was nothing to do. There's nothing in the Declaration of Independence about taxation without representation. It's all about the desire to establish a tyranny. And the word tyranny has been defined for 6,000 years as absolute power in the hands of government. Period. That's it. And when you talk about tyrannical despots or tyrants, you're talking about tyranny. Now, they went on to say in the second sentence, to prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. In other words, we're now going to, for those that want to know why we're doing this, we're going to list the way that he was creating this powerful, despotic, tyrannical, absolute tyranny. And the 30th one, or the 23rd one, rather, of the 30 reads as follows. King George was guilty of suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. That is the very definition of tyranny. He was creating his own legislatures to make it legal by having them pass laws, but there was absolutely no restriction on what kind of laws they could pass. That's what it means. Tyranny. Absolute. No limit. No Magna Carta. No concept of human rights. No concept of unalienable rights. Total government in the hands of King George and his own legislatures. Now, please remember the phrase, the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever. That was the Founding Fathers' way of describing the absolute tyranny that King George was creating in the United States. And we're declaring our independence from that. We're breaking all connections with England. And that was the reason, nothing to do with taxation without representation. We've been lied to about that as well. But please remember the phrase, I'll read it again. The power to legislate in all cases whatsoever.
But you said there's like 30 things that they mentioned there.
Melody, I can hardly hear you.
You said there's like 30 things that they mentioned there.
Well, there's 30 specific things they mentioned, yeah. But it's all about government, total power.
Okay.
Okay? But this is the way to summarize it, all cases whatsoever. Now let's go to the Constitution, passed 11 years later, 1787. And they created three branches of government to divide the power between the executive, the legislative, and the judicial, which is a great idea. See, they were saying we were to just come from an absolute tyrannical government of King George, and we're going to divide the power and then give checks and balances. But notice, I'm going to show you they didn't do that at all. Now, the Article 1 creates the legislative branch of government. That's Congress. And Article 1, Section 1, Clause 1 reads, all legislative powers herein granted. So someplace in this document, there are a list of specific powers delegated, granted. In other words, we're going to give Congress limited, specific powers, only those powers. All legislative powers herein granted. Now let's go to the 10th Amendment to confirm it. And the 10th Amendment reads, I'm flipping pages here, forgive me, here we go. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. Now, what did that just say? Those powers not delegated by the Constitution to the United States remain in the hands of the people, or the state legislature. So we're going to talk about powers granted, powers delegated. So someplace we're going to find a listing of the specific delegated, granted powers. And we can find that in Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 1 through 18. And I'll go there next.
And would you repeat that, please?
Yes. The Article 1,
okay.
Section 8, clauses 1 through 18.
Thank you.
Now, by the way, we are putting I have several copies of the Constitution. Some of them have numbers before these clauses. They don't call them clauses. We do that just to separate them. But this particular copy does have numbers. So this one says, one is so-and-so power, two is so-and-so, et cetera. And we're going to read those just very briefly. Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 1 through 18. 1. Congress shall have power to, and I'll just briefly summarize, borrow money, regulate commerce, establish a uniform rule of naturalization, coin money, punish counterfeiters, create post offices, constitute tribunals, meaning courts, punish piracy, declare war, raise an army, provide for a navy, make rules for governing the navy, etc., provide for calling forth the militia, provide organizing the militia, etc. And then we're going to read number 17. This is the key. Powers granted to Congress, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. Congress shall have the power to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever. Huh? What? Where have we seen those words before? In the Declaration. Identical. Same words. Exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever. Wait a minute. In 1776, we said that's tyranny. Absolute tyranny. Didn't we say those? Didn't we read that? Yes?
Now,
according to my constitution here, after that it says, over such district...
Oh, yes, please understand. We're going. I'm not denying that. I just want you to understand. We are giving Congress, our founding fathers, absolute, tyrannical, despotic, unlimited power. The same identical words. Now, we're going to confine it a little bit, and that's fine. We're going to explain that. But just understand, they use the same words. Why? I want to know why.
Wow.
Why would they do this? These are supposedly Christian men, decent men, who are afraid of total government. But they just gave Congress absolute power.
Then why do so many scholars of the Constitution and such not even go there?
I wonder why. Don't forget, if I'm right, there's been a conspiracy in this government for 200 years. They don't want this known. And I'll give you the evidence. Congress is voting money for stem cell research. Where did our founding fathers delegate that power? Where? Did you hear anything about stem cell research in those listing of powers in Article 1, Section 8? I didn't see anything about stem cell research. How about trips to the moon? How could our founding fathers... I don't even know what stem cell research is. But Congress is funding it. Why? They've only got specified delegated powers, but they're doing it. Why? Where's the power to build this socialized medicine, whatever it is that Obama wants? I didn't hear that in there either. How about the Hubble Space Telescope? Where'd that come from? How could our founding fathers understood space telescopes? How could they have even envisioned such a thing to delegate the power? They didn't delegate it. According to the 10th Amendment, those powers not delegated by the Constitution to the United States remain with the people or the states. So we've got to find a delegated specific power, and it's not listed. The 10th Amendment says if we didn't list it, you don't have it. But Congress has it. Where did they get it from? Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. Here's the way to stop Obama's program. If you want to stop his socialized medicine program, what you do is you ask your congressman, you took an oath to support, protect, and defend the Constitution. Oh, yes, I'm sure they'll say, you bet. I did. I raised my hand on a Bible and in front of my wife and family and kids and everybody else. All the congressmen did it together. We did. Okay, well then, I'm going to read the 10th Amendment. All powers not delegated by the Constitution to the United States remain. Okay, now that means that we've got to find the delegated power. Why did you vote for stem cell research when it's not delegated? Please show me in Article 1, Section 8 where the power of the delegated is delegated for stem cell research. Show me that, please. Now,
how did we get here, Ralph?
I'm telling you, there's been a conspiracy at work, including our founding fathers. That's the point. I know it's not pleasant. We've been taught the exact opposite. That's the problem. Remember what I said. I was asked to read revisionist history. We're being lied to.
Okay.
That's why I've had to write four books. I'm telling you, our founding fathers created this nation to fail. We're reading the evidence of it. I'm asking the question, where is the delegated power for stem cell research? Congress should have the power to fund stem cell research. Congress should have the power to send men to the moon or walk in space or send orbiting objects around. Where's that? If we had the power, Melody, you and I and Katie, had the power to go time travel and showed up amongst the founding fathers and said in 1787 as they're deliberating the Constitution, gentlemen, we're from the future. And we want you, we know that you're delegating powers and only those powers to Congress. So we're from the future. Here's some proof of it. We got some newspaper or clip or something to show them that we're from the future. And we said, we want you to delegate the power for stem cell research. They would have said, what's that? What? They would have had no idea. Oh, no, we want you to also delegate the power for walks in space. What walk is, where? They don't even know what the word space means. It was earth and heaven in those days.
Okay, space. When you were, I was going through your book on the unseen hand, you get into a discussion a little bit on stated insurance policies and all risk, and I thought it was really kind of a good definition of, I think, where you're going with this.
Okay. In fact, I'm glad you brought that up. I used to work in the insurance industry.
I was wondering if you did.
Yeah. I was never a salesman. I just worked as an underwriter for the company. So we learned there's two different ways to write insurance. One is what they call the named peril form. I'll use my house as an example. My house is covered for fire, explosion, riot, vehicle damage, windstorms, hail, and that's it. Let's just make it simple. So now, if I have a buffalo stampede through my house and they knock it down, it's not covered because it's not one of the stated, specified perils. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, or maybe there's a here in Arizona, there's a glacier comes down the mountain and knocks my house down. And I go to my insurance company. Hey, listen, I got insurance on that. No, you don't, because glaciers are damage is not covered. So that's one way to do it. The other way to do it is cover everything except that which is excluded. So in this case, you read the exclusions. This policy does not cover for glacier retreat or buffalo stampede or floods or earthquake or whatever else. So that's the way the Constitution was written in what I call the named peril form. It means we list the coverage we've got. We've got the power to raise an army, the power to declare war, to create a post office. That's it. There's 18 of them.
Okay, but what it sounds like you're saying, and if I'm following correctly, is almost like they're saying in one part that it's a stated peril, and the other part they're saying all risk.
I'm saying that the secret thing is that they know they've got absolute power. This is why Congress funds stem cell research.
But it doesn't sound like you're saying it's secret. It's
no,
just
no. I'm saying, please. I'll use the example. Here's better. Maybe another example. I live in Tucson, Arizona. Outside of our city is a movie set called Old Tucson. It's now a theme park. It was a set made in 1939 for a movie called Arizona. Now, many of those buildings are fake. If they want you to walk down the main street, and there's the bank on the right, and then you go to the left, there's the sheriff's office and the jail, and then there's a mercantile store, and then the barber, and the cake shop, and the whatever else, restaurants and bars, saloons. Many of those buildings are fake. As long as you walk down the main street, those buildings look real, and that's why the camera is in the street, not around back. Because you go around back, it's just a false front. Oh, no, in the front of the building, it looks like a bank. It says it's a bank. People actually walk through the doors, everything else. But it's a set. It's a fake. That's the Constitution. They did that intentionally, and they want us to walk down the main street and look at the Constitution. Oh, here's the name perils. We give insurance terms now. We've got the coverage to declare war, raise an army and navy, and to call out the militia and create post offices, and that's it. But I'm asking you, where is the delegated power to fund stem cell research? Our founding fathers could have never envisioned such a thing. But we're doing it. Why? Because Congress knows that they've got unlimited power. They know that.
But you are saying, and this is where I'm hoping I'm following you again, and I'm sorry if I'm not, but it sounds like in the other the Article 1, Section 8, you're saying that they give themselves that power to do that. It is there in sight. It's just most people don't. It's not focused on.
No, absolutely right. And ask, go on campus and talk to political science majors. When was the last time you studied the Constitution? Well, I've never done that. What is an unalienable right? I have no idea. What is it? What is that? What's a militia? I was invited to speak to a group. Because the teacher thought that I was a member of Arizona's militia, which I was not, but I went anyway. And I walked in the room and I said, I want to thank you for inviting me to this meeting of the militia. And they were puzzled. What do you mean? And I got the Constitution out and said, you people are the militia. Did you know that? Has your teacher taught you? This was during Bill Clinton's days. I said, Bill Clinton has the power under the Constitution to call you out of school and send you out to fight in our wars. Did you know that? You're the militia. If there's a national emergency, you're going to be called out. Now, you thought I was the militia. I'm too old. The militia is specified by the Constitution and laws that were passed in accordance with it.
How did
18 to 44 or something in sound mind or something, have to be armed, everything else.
Okay, but how did you define militia?
Well, it's all defined by the laws and the Constitution. It's as I said, I think males only. Of course, that was back in the 1780s. Males only, between 18 I think and 44, armed and in good health, something like that.
But doesn't that mean something to do with defending the country here? Is
yes.
Okay.
But the point was that they didn't know there was such a thing as a militia. Now why? Bill Clinton could have called this group out, whether they liked it or not, and there would be people coming to take them. You are the militia. Well, I didn't know about that. That's the point. They don't know. They don't know what it means, the right to private property, the right to these unalienable rights that God gives us, life, liberty, and the right to private property.
Explain that a little bit.
Well, the first thing we've got to deal with is that every human being is created hungry. That's it. If you don't feed yourself, you die. I'm sorry, that's the way it is. You say, I want to be a poet and sit in the corner and recite poetry for the rest of my life. Okay, go do that and see what happens. I'm sorry, you're not going to survive. You got to go out and work. No, you don't. No, we're going to sit on the side and read poetry or look at the clouds or, you know, contemplate my navel, whatever it is. So you need property. God gave us food, but you have to cultivate it, grow it. It doesn't just fall into your lap. Notice the wheat fields. Those are grown, cultivated. People have to work to plant the seeds, keep the wolves and the animals up from eating it, the rabbits, etc. Keep the weeds out. Make sure it's watered.
Okay, when you're saying property,
that's called private property.
Okay,
but
you
have to be free to work to do it. That's called liberty.
Okay, and are you saying the food is the property, or the property that you grow it on is the property, and
both?
Or both? Okay.
You have to have both. In other words, if the state owns the land and won't let me grow, that's private. That's property, but it's not private. That's the point. It's private property, which means I own my land. And I'm free to grow wheat on it or corn or whatever I want.
Now, is that an alienable right?
Unalienable right, yes.
Okay.
By the way, what does the word unalienable mean?
Okay.
It means it can't be taken. See, governments can take rights, and when they do, they're not called rights, they're called privileges. They call driving a privilege. Why? No, it's a right. I have the right to go from point A to point B. If I need to buy corn and there's none grown locally and I got to travel to get the corn, I've got the right to do that because I'm hungry. I need to sustain my life with corn, let's say. So I'm free to travel. I have the unalienable right to travel. Now, I can't walk through my your house, so I've got to go around it, but that's fine. As long as there's a way to get to the corn, I'm happy. I've got a right to do that. No, it's a privilege. And if a privilege is granted by government, it can be taken away by government. The United Nations said that. And those rights provided by the state. No, no. The Constitution, the Declaration says they're unalienable, given to us by our Creator. And only the Creator of the right can take it away. God has chosen not to do that. But the state says, we'll give you your rights, and then they become not alienable, unalienable. They become privileges. And the privilege can be removed. Hitler had a law passed saying the Jews were not people. And they could kill them. They're not even protected by government. I mean, it's done by law. The power to legislate in all cases whatsoever. Hitler had it as well. That's what dictators do. They make sure you live by privilege. We don't live by right anymore. We don't even know what the word unalienable means anymore. We don't even use it. I use it all the time. Unalienable. God gave it to me. We were endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. What does that mean? Only God can take them away. No man, no government, no majority, no nation, no minority, no people, no neighbor, no one. No one has the right. Now, of course, we have people murdering and raping and stealing all the time. But they have no right to do it. And because they don't have the right to do it, that's why we punish them. Hopefully we punish them enough to make them stop doing that. Of course, our courts now turn them out free before the policeman could even fill out the paper about what happened. They're back out on the street.
I don't know. With the prison system we've got going now,
Secondly, we don't rehabilitate anybody. We should spend time with these prisoners and say, listen, let me tell you why you're in jail. You violated someone's unalienable right to property. Let's say you stole their money, $40,000. You stole their right. Now, how would you like it if someone stole your private property? They don't like it. There was a story in the papers once about a policeman teaching children about graffiti, children who were spray painting everything, and he got them all together and said, okay, guys, here's what we're going to do. One at a time, I want you to come up to the front, and I'm going to spray paint your shirts. I really like to spray paint your shirts. I'm going to put the name of the police department on the back and put an eagle. And they said, no, you're not. Wait, I don't understand why. You guys do that all the time. I'm going to do it now to you. And they didn't want that to happen. Hopefully they learned the lesson. The reason they don't have the right to spray paint someone's property is because they don't want their private property spray painted. So hopefully you can teach them don't spray paint someone else's property. But it's happening all the time. Graffiti, it's everywhere. Because we're not teaching children about unalienable rights and why this thing talked about all men are created with these unalienable rights. By the way, the word men, even then meant men and women, generic, the humans, all humans have the unalienable right. It's not men and women, it was everybody, both sexes.
Yeah, but did they give that to all races?
I can't hear you.
Did they give that to all races?
Oh, well, no, that's... I didn't say the Constitution was perfect. I'm telling you, there was a conspiracy. And Thomas Jefferson, the guy who wrote the Declaration of Independence, had slaves. We talked about all men being created equal. That cannot be explained rationally. This man owned slaves, Thomas Jefferson, and yet he wrote that in the Constitution, in the Declaration. And in the Constitution, they counted slaves as 3/5 of a human being. Oh, that's nice.
Well, you know, one of the things that I was noticing when I was viewing your DVDs is that seems to be like a very fatal flaw designed in it that is going to be our undoing. I mean, that is opening the door for us to become the slaves.
Well, I'm telling you, our founding fathers had a different God than we did. And that's a matter, it takes a long time to do that, but please understand, I've done it in my book called The New World Order. And it was the first, if I may, I published the book in 1990, about 4 months before George Bush, the father, the first George Bush, talked about it in the some speech about the New World Order. The Gulf War is going to create a New World Order.
That was
talked about it, named my book, The New World Order.
I think that was actually delivered on 9/11 back then, too.
Yes. My book came out, I think, in July of that year.
So
it was ready in 1989. And by the way, I talked about the New World Order in 1985 when I toured the country with my first book, The Unseen Hand. I showed pictures of the slide, showed pictures of the map of the Great Seal. I showed pictures of the map of Washington, D.C. and started to show these symbols and the hidden concealed signs in their map of Washington, D.C. Now everybody's doing it. Dan Brown's writing books about it.
Who was it? Who were the men that you were of his, that wrote the history that started cluing you in on some of this?
Well, I wish I could say it was one book or one whatever. That's the point. That's why I've read over 1,000 books. You have to, it's something you have to, it's not, if I may, The Unseen Hand, even though it's now 24 years old, is still the best book, and I know, I'm saying this, I'm the guy that wrote it, but I'm also getting letters even 25 years later. That book is still the encyclopedia about conspiracy in this nation. People use it as their reference source. They keep it on the shelf. It's all marked up. I get people calling me all the time saying, my book is so badly, I've read it 10 times and it's all marked up. I want a new copy.
Melody, we probably need to do station identification.
Okay, yes. This is KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community supported radio. And we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And Ralph, would you like to give your website?
Yo, thank you very much. Yes, it's www, of course, Ralph, R-A-L-P-H, dash, hyphen, if you will, dash or hyphen, Epperson, E-P-P as in Peter, E-R-S-O-N.com. Go there and browse and read. It's my whole catalog. Everything's listed, everything I've ever produced. Well, not every. I've taken things out of the marketplace and replaced them with others. But the current edition of my catalog is on the Internet right now, www.ralph-epperson.com. Thank you.
Okay. So to go back to where we left off. Oh, let me say one other thing. The views expressed on this program are those of myself and are my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. Okay.
Well, I'd like to hear a little bit about the Uniform Commercial Code.
Okay, well, if I may, let's continue with our study of the Constitution, and we'll get into that, and we should be able to cover that probably in about 5 or 10 minutes or so.
Okay, thank you.
With your permission.
Sure.
Let's finish this story. You were right, Katie, when you pointed out that Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 points out that they're giving this Congress power only in Washington, D.C. Let's read it. To exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district, I'm going to delete certain parts of it, as may become the seat of the government of the United States. Now, let's talk about this. We do not live in the United States. I live in the state of Arizona, and you people live in Colorado. We are part of the United States of America, and only Washington, D.C. is the United States. So there's two different governments.
So I've heard that referred to as the corporation.
Yeah, well, that's another story. I'm not going to. It is. It's. You can find the documents of incorporation of the government of the United States. But let's just leave it at that. Just go with that. Only Washington, D.C. is the United States. Now, Congress rules Washington, D.C. with absolute, unlimited, despotic, tyrannical power, as we just read. The power to exercise legislation in all cases whatsoever. That's the power of tyranny. Now, let me give you an example. Congress, to give you two examples that appeared in my local newspaper, I clicked them out and saved them in my files. One was that Washington, D.C. has a curfew. Now, where's that? Where does Congress have the power to impose a curfew on the people of Washington, D.C.? It's not listed. But notice, they have the power to do everything in all cases whatsoever. So they said, okay, we're going to have a curfew, whether you like it or not. Congress did that. Congress runs the affairs of Washington, D.C. with unlimited power. The second little article was about a guy being found or discovered wearing a holster and a belt, and he had his gun in the holster, and he was arrested for keeping an unregistered or unlicensed gun or something, so he was arrested. Here in Arizona, I go to meetings all the time with people carrying guns and holsters because of the Second Amendment. The right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, period. Zip. That's it. But no. In Washington, there is no right to keep and bear arms. So because they've got the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever. Now, the point is that somehow you and I became citizens of the United States. We've done so, and we have given them jurisdiction over us. How did we do that? Are you ready? You want to find out?
Sure.
Are you afraid?
Almost.
Okay. Now, the United States of America is only the 50 states. Of course, then it was 13. They had their own state governments, and the powers that were listed in Article 1, Section 8, exclusive of 18, were for the United States of America, meaning they have the right to declare war for the United States of America, raise post offices to keep the mail circulating, punish piracy, etc. That was it. So now, let's talk about how you and I have voluntarily given Congress absolute power over everything we do, including taxing us for stem cell research, for trips to the moon, for foreign aid, for aid to education, for socialized medicine, whatever it is, they've got the power. Now, let me show how this happened. After the Civil War, the 13th Amendment was passed, and you get your copy of it. Go to the back of the Constitution and read the 13th Amendment. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, shall exist within the United States. Okay? So that means that Washington, D.C. said there's not going to be any slavery or involuntary servitude. Now, what does slavery mean? Forcing someone to do something they don't want to do, or under contract even. Notice the slaves during the Civil War, the intent was allegedly to free the slaves. But Lincoln did that with the Emancipation Proclamation. So there might have been another reason for this thing, and I'll try to explain what it is. Now, slavery in the South was, the man was bought by the master, and he was told what to do, when to do it, how often, and what kind of food he was going to be given, where he was going to live, and if he ran away, he was picked up as property and brought back. That's called slavery, forcing an individual to serve another. Now, but notice one more thing. Voluntary servitude is permitted. It says involuntary. You can become a slave anytime you want to. That's called freedom. You can become a slave. You can contract anyone to do anything. Okay? So voluntary servitude is permitted in the 13th Amendment. Now let's go to the 14th Amendment. This passed 2 years later. The first one was 1865. The 14th Amendment was 1868. Okay. All persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. Let's go slow. Notice we were called the people of the United States of America. People. People were granted unalienable rights by God, our Creator, and that no man, no government could take them away. Now suddenly we're called persons. A person lives by privilege instead of unalienable rights. That's a legal definition.
Where did that come about? Where did this, that term come in at?
Right at the moment, the best answer I give is in, it's in Black's Law Dictionary, but I'm, all I can tell you is that they changed, they didn't say all people, it said persons, and I'm gonna try to prove to you that they knew what it meant, because we live by privilege now. But it goes on, all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States. What were we before the 14th Amendment? We were not called citizens of the United States because we weren't born in Washington, D.C. We were born in Georgia or Alabama or Colorado or Arizona or whatever.
But after that in mind, I have, and of the state wherein they reside. So wouldn't that be like dual citizenship?
Exactly. But the key is that we now become citizens of the all-powerful government with the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever, and we've done it voluntarily. How? There is no law requiring us to get a Social Security card. No law. Oh, no, Ralph, everybody knows we have to get, you can't get a job without it. No. You can use a socialist, by the way, I'm going to call it what it is, a socialist security card. You can, once you get a number, you can tell, once you don't have a number, you can tell your boss, with a Social Security form, that you're not going to, you're not a citizen of the United States, and therefore they have no power to tax you. And sign it, and the Social Security Administration, who issues the form, has to accept it. We volunteered to get the card. No, no, everybody know. No, show me the law. There is no law. There is no law requiring us to pay income taxes. We volunteer. I've got proof of that. There are people getting out of it all the time all over this country who have discovered there is no law.
But it's a little bit under coercion, is it not?
Yes, ma'am. It's the mental thing. We're told, everybody knows, you have to get a card. No, you'd show me the law. By the way, ladies, let me ask you to do the same thing that I've done. I am an honorary citizen. The people in Missouri don't know this, but I'm an honorary citizen of Missouri. Missouri is called a show-me state, which means show me the law. If you say I got to get a card, show me the law. You can't do it. There's no law. Show me. Show me. There's no law. I got letters written by the Social Security Administration. I showed them in my DVD called America's Secret Destiny. That say it's voluntary. Why? Because the 14th Amendment says involuntary servitude, again, the 13th Amendment, is illegal. They can't force you to do anything, but they can get you to believe there's law. Don't forget, the movie camera's always in front of the set, not around back. They don't show you that there's no roof, no ceiling. The same thing with the law. We think there's a law. It sounds like a law, we're told there's law, but there's no law. And legally, this is called color of law. Look it up in the Black's Law Dictionary. By the way, the law profession has their own dictionary. They don't use Webster. They call it the Black's Law Dictionary. Color of law. Sounds like a law, looks like a law. Even people think there's law, but there's no law. Show me the law. Aaron Russo made a movie. He was a producer of movies in Hollywood, and he made a movie, and he showed it around the country. I've forgotten the name of it.
Freedom to Fascism.
Thank you. You might remember in there, he interviews a lady on a jury that found a man not guilty of failure to file income taxes. And she told the story. She said, I was sitting in the court listening as a juror, and the man who was arguing his case kept showing a video of him sitting with two IRS agents in a room, just the three of them, and he's recording it with his video camera at the end of the table. So you can see all three people in the papers that are shuffling around. So he kept asking, gentlemen, please, I would appreciate it. These are IRS agents. Please just show me the law. As soon as you show me the law and I read it and it says I've got to pay the taxes, I will gladly pay my taxes. And they never answered the question. They kept shuffling papers and getting off the subject. And he kept saying, please, I'm just asking you to show me the law. So he showed this in the courtroom as part of his defense. There is no law. Now, when the judge turned the case over to the jury, according to this lady who was on the jury, she said, you are here to decide the facts of the case. Did the man pay income taxes or not? That's the only question you're here to decide. I will provide you with the law. So the jury went in the room and said, okay, let's decide. You know, it's very, very clear he didn't pay the taxes, but he kept asking for the law. So let's ask the judge for the law. He promised us the law. So they sent a note to the bailiff, to the judge, please, judge, you promised us the law. Please supply it so we can decide if the man's guilty under the law. And nothing happened. So a little while later, they sent a second note in. I think there was three of them in total. I could be wrong. So they sent a second note in. Please, judge, where's the law? We're waiting for the law. You said you'd promise us the law, and the judge did nothing. And they sent a third note in. Please send us the law. You promised us, judge. You said there's a law. Please show us what it is. And nothing. So they said, well, obviously then there must not be any law. So as the man tried to point out and couldn't get an answer from the two IRS agents, there's no law. So they found the man not guilty. So the judge said to the jury foreman, have you reached a verdict? He said, yes, sir, we have. What is your verdict? And the man said, we find the guilty, defendant not guilty. And according to the little lady, the judge's mouth fell open. There's no law. The 13th Amendment says involuntary servitude. If you're forced to obey the law to pay the taxes, that's called involuntary servitude. It's not permitted. But voluntary servitude is. You can voluntary anytime you want to be a serf. Well, we've done that. We do it all the time. Now, let's now take the big leap. Those of you that have been reading somewhat of the papers, it's not a major story, but there's a story going around the country of several people who have filed court cases to determine whether or not Barack Obama is a natural-born citizen of the United States, or natural-born, is all it says. Now, they claim he was born in Kenya, which is a foreign nation. So therefore, he's not natural-born, which is a requirement for the presidency of the United States. You have to be natural-born, born in the United States or the United States of America. So Obama was born in Kenya. So they said to the Supreme Court, you have the authority to decide this man is not eligible under the Constitution to become President of the United States. Now, there's a man running around by the name of Philip Berg, who is an attorney, who's filed, I believe, the greatest cases to the Supreme Court to get an answer. So right around the time of the, I think it was the election, a friend of mine who ran a talk show called me and said, I've got this man on as a guest. If you want to talk to him, Ralph, call him. So I called him and said, I got in as a guest. I said, you don't know me, Mr. Berg. I want to thank you, first of all, for what you're doing, and I believe you're right. He was born in Kenya, a foreign nation, and therefore is not eligible under the Constitution. But I want you to know something, Mr. Berg. You will not get an answer from the Supreme Court. This was during the inauguration. In fact, I think it was before the election. If Obama's elected, he's not eligible. And he said, well, why? Now, hold on, America. This is not going to be fun. I said, Mr. Berg, because the Supreme Court has ruled that the Constitution is null and void. What? What did you just say? I said, the Supreme Court in 1938 ruled the Constitution is null and void. And that's why they're not going to give you an answer, because there is no Constitution. He said, what are you saying? I said, if you want to read the case, Mr. Berg, you know how to find Supreme Court decisions in every law library in this country. They list Supreme Court decisions. Get the book out. 1938. It's called the Erie Railroad versus Tompkins case. And the Supreme Court has ruled there is no federal general, no federal common law. Well, what's the common law? The Constitution. Now, where did they get the power to do that? The power to legislate in all cases whatsoever. If the Congress didn't like what they were doing, they could have overturned the Supreme Court under the checks and balances. But they've not done that. That means to me that even our congressmen and our senators know there is no Constitution. And now, just about, or maybe in June, a couple of months ago, I got in a second time on another talk show with Mr. Berg. And I said, Mr. Berg, it's now been, if it was the election we talked, it's been 8 months since then. Do you have an answer yet from the Supreme Court? He said, no. I said, Mr. Berg, I'm the one that told you you wouldn't get one. Oh, by the way, going back the first time, I said, Mr. Berg, please call me. I can give you other cases to confirm this for you. He said, I will do that. I said, the station knows me. Ask them to give you the stay online when you get off the air. He was going to finish because it was in the last 10 minutes or so. I said, stay on the line, and they'll give you my phone number and call me. Please, Mr. Berg, I'll give you the documentation that this is true. Yeah, I'll do that. Well, he never called. Now, you can argue any reason you want to. I'm not going to get into that. I don't know why he didn't call. So then the second time I said, Mr. Berg, I asked you to call me, please. I want to document this for you with other cases as well to prove it's real. So I said, no. Now, that was the end of the conversation. He never called then either. And he still, to this day, now this is what, September, still has no answer. And the reason is the Constitution requirement that the president be natural-born is not valid anymore. There is no Constitution. It's gone. Now, what are we living under? Now, I'm going to tell you two stories that I believe to be true. It's up to you, the listening audience as well. You'll have to decide for yourself. But I believe, the greatest constitutional expert in this nation probably 10 years ago by the name of Howard Freeman. He passed away in 1992, which is... Oh, that's 10 years ago. I must have met him before then, because I knew him back in the middle 90s.
You're getting closer to 20 years ago.
Huh?
You're getting closer to 20 years ago.
Yeah, probably so. By the way, he died in 1992, I said. Yes, that's 17 years ago already. Okay. Well, I met him must have been 20 years ago, or 25 even. But he came to Tucson probably in 1990, and he told us two stories. The man who brought him to speak was a friend of mine, and he was the president of a club that invited him and said, come and listen, Ralph, just ask your questions. Howard wants to talk, and he's going to talk to us. So we sat around in a circle in a living room, and Howard Freeman told us two stories. I'm going to do it as briefly as I can, and you'll have to decide for yourself. Number one story, Howard Freeman was helping a young man, a friend of his, defend his case that he did not pay income taxes. So he was charged with failure to file, and he pled not guilty, and he asked Howard Freeman to get up on the stand and be his expert witness and cite the Constitution, the cases that have been decided that prove that you don't have to pay income taxes. So Howard Freeman got up there, and under the leading of this young man, asking the right questions, Howard testified. I don't remember a number, but let's say 10 cases that said there's no one has to pay income tax. So Howard Freeman said he sat down in the room after, you know, in the seats after his testimony, and when the judge turned the case over to the jury, he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm admonishing you to completely disregard the testimony of Howard Freeman." And Freeman, who was a very mild-mannered man, said, he can't do that. That's probably as angry as he ever got. And so he raced around back and caught the judge going into his courtroom, into his office, across the hall, apparently, from the courtroom. And he said, Your Honor, oh, yes, Mr. Freeman. He said, Your Honor, you took an oath to protect and support the Constitution. He said, yes, I did. He said, well, Your Honor, you are obligated to abide by Supreme Court decisions. You're a federal court, inferior to the Supreme Court. That's true, he said. Yes, I am. He said, well, then you've got to abide by standing Supreme Court decisions. And the judge said, well, they're not standing Supreme Court decisions. He said, what do you mean? You can't overturn Supreme Court decisions. He said, all of those cases were prior to 1938. 1938. So Friedman said, wait a minute, what happened in 1938 to eliminate standing Supreme Court decisions? He said, I've told you too much, and walked in the door, shut it, and locked it. End of conversation. So Freeman said, wait a minute, he must be telling me something because that's what he did. So Freeman went looking into the Supreme Court cases in every law library in the country and looked in 1938 at the Supreme Court and found the case, Erie Railroad versus Tompkins, 1938, in which it says there is no general common law. But the second story confirms what he just told us. He then went on to say, let me tell you my second story. He said, I live in Wyoming. I'm a citizen up there. I live in a small rural area, and I got a phone call from a judge, a retired state Supreme Court judge, called me. I didn't know the man. He called me, and I said, "What can I do? Who are you, and what can I do?" He said, "Well, I'm so and so, and I'm a retired state Supreme Court justice, and I want to talk to you, Mr. Freeman. Please come over." So Freeman got in his little car and journeyed over there, probably shaking. He's going to be a retired state Supreme Court justice. Notice, not federal, state Supreme Court. So Freeman went in, and the man says, Mr. Freeman, I've been watching you for years. I want to commend you for your courage and your dedication and your commitment to the truth. You are right, but you've got to know what I know. He said, okay. He said, I was a federal judge prior to becoming appointed to the state Supreme Court in my state of Wyoming. So he said, and in 1938, all of the federal judges were called, and the attorneys, federal attorneys, were called together by Franklin Roosevelt, President of the United States. Now remember this, all the judges are appointed by the President and confirmed by the Senate. This is what just happened with the Sotomayor, the new Supreme Court Justice. She was appointed by Barack Obama and then confirmed by the Senate.
Is that the only positions that are confirmed by...
No, I think all federal judges are.
Okay, but I'm saying, is it only judges that are confirmed, no cabinet or any of that other...
I don't think cabinet members have to be confirmed. I could be wrong. I don't know. Maybe so. It seemed like Hillary was testifying. Maybe some of them are. I don't know. But anyway... This was only the judges because they have to adjudicate cases now on the new law. So according to this judge, he said, we were all called together by the boss, and he said, let me tell you this, ladies and gentlemen. He said, as you remember, in 1933, I suspended the gold certificate redemption clause written on our money. And it says something like this. This certifies that there is on deposit in so-and-so bank or any bank $10 in gold if it's a $10 gold certificate payable on demand to the bearer, which means you could walk in with a gold certificate of $10 and ask for your gold and get it right now. Payable on demand. They didn't wait. They didn't have, you got your gold right away. He suspended that redemption clause, even though there's nothing. It's a contract. We, our government, agreed to do this. There's no stipulation, comma, except when the president rescinds it or revokes it or changes his mind or it's act of Congress. It's upon demand. There's no conditions. But Roosevelt did it anyway. And so the American people turned in their gold certificates and their gold, and they pulled them off the market. Now we got Federal Reserve notes. And there's no such commitment. But Roosevelt did this. And then he went on to explain, ladies and gentlemen, the holders of our national debt, the international bankers, have declared that to be an act of a bankrupt nation. And as such, they are demanding that we no longer adjudicate cases on the Constitution, but on the Uniform Commercial Code. And you are to take silent judicial notice of that fact. Now that, once again, is a legal definition in the Black's Law Dictionary. That means, in my simple Arizona language, you can't tell the dummies. And this is why the Supreme Court will not answer Philip Byrd. Because they can't. They're not going to say, ladies and gentlemen, there is no such requirement in the Constitution because it was declared null and void in 1938 by the Erie Railroad versus Tompkins case. They're not going to say that. They can't. Now, let me give you proof that the common law doesn't exist. All the way down to a small farming community in Arizona from another friend of mine in another incident. He was driving in the town of Eloy, Arizona, which is a small farming community, probably 80 miles or whatever from Tucson. And he's driving along and he stops at a stoplight or a stop sign and makes an illegal right-hand turn. There was no passing lane. He turned to the right. The policeman stops him. And the policeman says, you just violated the Arizona Revised Statute so-and-so, 2584, or whatever it is, and here's your ticket. He got his driver's license and insurance and registration and everything else, and asked him whatever it was. So he said, the policeman said, you have three options. You can take the envelope that comes with the ticket, since you're from Tucson, not from Eloy, and you can pay the fine right now, put it in the envelope, drop it in a mailbox, and we'll get it, and we'll close this matter out. Or you could take it to Tucson and do the same thing with a check or cash and drop it in the mail. You've got 10 days to do that. Or the third option is you can see the judge. So my friend said, I want to see the judge. So he goes to the judge, and after he might be number five, there's others waiting in turn. The policeman went with him because he's the expert witness to testify. I saw this man make the illegal right-hand turn, and he's been determined by court decree to be an expert witness about traffic violations. So the first thing happened was the judge to the audience says, in the matter of the city of Eloy versus Bill Jones, I'll make up a name. Bill Jones, are you in the court, Mr. Jones? And he said, yes, sir, I'm right here. He said, well, Mr. Jones, how do you plead in this matter of making the illegal right-hand turn? He said, well, Your Honor, before I plead, may I ask a question? Now, you're permitted under the Constitution to understand the nature of your charges and the court you're in. So he's going to do that. He's going to find out. In other words, if the Constitution's real. So he said, well, what is your question, Mr. Jones? And Mr. Jones said, now, I need to know what type of court I am in. And the judge said, well, Mr. Jones, you're in the traffic court of the city of Eloy, Arizona, a chartered corporation created by the state legislature of Arizona. Well, thank you very much, Your Honor, for answering my question. But now I've got a second question. What is your second question? Now, I'm going to give you the whole question, then we'll come back to what happened. The whole question is, well, Your Honor, I need to know what type of court I'm in. Is this a common law, court of equity, or admiralty law court? That's the full question. Those are the only three types of court in the world, especially in the Constitution. Now, before he got past the comma after law, the judge banged the gavel down in anger and shouted at Mr. Jones, according to him. I've known this man for 25 years, or even more. So he said, shouted, case dismissed. Don't you ever come back to my court, Mr. Jones. Now, wait a minute. He made the illegal right enter. The court's got the witness there to see it. There it is. The man can see. The policeman, where were you in the, at 10 o'clock this morning? I was waiting at the so-and-so or at the Dunkin' Donut shop, and I saw this man drive and make the illegal right turn, so I stopped him, and we went and everything else. He's an expert. He made the illegal right-hand turn. Why would he dismiss? Because it's not a common law court. Now, what is the common law? It's the law of God. What is the law of God? If you violate someone's person or their property, you've got to make restitution. That's the only way you can have... That's what a common law is. So the question is, who did he violate? Whose property did he damage by making the illegal right-hand turn? No one. He didn't run over some nuns in the crosswalk. He didn't knock over a kid on a bicycle. He didn't knock down the fence. He didn't knock down a telephone pole. He made an illegal right-hand turn on pavement. Didn't run over anybody. Who's the damaged party? because under the Constitution, you have the right to face your accusers to determine if you did indeed do the damages. But that doesn't exist anymore. Either you did or did not make the illegal right hand turn. Either you did or did not pay the taxes. That's it.
So what? But I guess I'm losing the fact of where his why he would have dismissed him then. I mean, as if he didn't.
Because the judge knew there were no common law courts. In other words, it wasn't just the federal judges. It's down all the way down to a traffic court in the middle of Arizona in a small farming community.
And so he just didn't want to admit it?
Is that he can't.
Okay.
Silent judicial notice. And his answer, now wait, if he said, well, this is not a common law court, he said, well, then if it, and by the way, this is all spelled out in the UCC connection, because Howard Freeman put it in writing, how you handle this in the court. If he says it's not a common law court, they say, okay, fine, then it's either a court of equity or a court of admiralty law. Admiralty law is the law of the ocean, so that means I've signed a contract with some maritime interest, and if you can produce the contract, I will examine it, and if I signed it, I will abide by the decision of this court.
So is admiralty law the UCC?
Law of equity, which is okay. You signed a contract. Melody, let's just say I buy your car, and I'll make it simple. I buy it for $1,000, and I'll pay you $100 a month for 10 months. It's a contract. We sign it and date it and notarize it and everything else. And then after 5 payments, I stop paying you. I said, Melody, I don't want to pay you anymore. I don't like you. I don't like your car. So you say, wait a minute, we got a contract, Ralph, you got to pay. No, I don't. So you go to court. That's called a court of equity. You go there and say, Your Honor, I've got this contract with Ralph, and he was going to pay me $100 a month for 10 months to pay off the car, and then the car was his. But he stopped paying. Well, the court then says to Ralph Epperson, did you sign this contract, Mr.? Yes, I did. Then pay her. No, I don't want it. Pay her. It's a contract. You sign, you're obligated to complete the contract. That's called court of equity. That's
okay.
It.
Okay.
Because you're damaged. You signed a contract for $1,000, and so did I, and I'm supposed to pay you, and I didn't.
Okay, now the interesting part where you're getting, when you started out with the beginnings of the Constitution and the founders who wrote it, the slippery slope on all of this is the deceiving that takes place in getting some of these contracts or implied contracts and that sort, and double language, or I don't know if there's another word I want better for that one, but you know, having a double meaning for a word, and they mean it one way and we take it to be another way, and that seems to be throughout what was taking place when they designed the Constitution, and then it seems to be taking place in these courts, in a sense, if they're not being upfront of what you're even dealing with, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
It's called color of law.
Okay.
We think there's a law. We signed it. It's a contract. Now, when I took, I'm not an attorney. I'm not giving legal advice. I can't because I'm not an attorney. I didn't go to law school. But I took a class in business law when I was in college. I majored in business. And in there we learned there's only two ways out of a contract. Either you can get both parties to agree, like going back to a contract between you and I, you could say, okay, fine, Ralph, you don't have to pay me anymore. We can both rip up the contract. Or I could prove, wait a minute, Melody, you told me it was a 1974 Edsel. It's not a 74 Edsel, it's a 64 Edsel. And therefore, you lied to me. And I could go to court and prove that, show the court the record, the contract, and the court would then say the contract's null and void. That's only two ways out of a contract. That's what the court would do under the common law. Either if I forced you, let's say I held a gun at your head, or you held a gun at my head, signed the paper, Ralph, and I can prove that by force you made me sign the contract, even though it's my signature, I could get out of the contract. But notice, once you sign a contract with the Social Security Administration, you're obligated to keep the terms of the contract, which keep paying your taxes.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, though, but then you get these credit card things in the mail that change the contracts all the time.
Yes.
So when you, admiralty law, that refers to anything that has to do with water?
Yes. It's the law of the ocean. Now, let me ask you point out this. When you're out on the ocean, the captain of that ship has absolute power. That's why, remember on the Love Boat with Gavin McLeod, he could marry couples out, not in the waters or the rivers. You had to wait till he got out past the international daylight, six-mile limit. Once he's out there in the ocean, he can marry couples. And if he says, if the ship is floundering and he needs to jettison cargo, he can do it without a vote. He doesn't have to vote. He just dumps the stuff overboard. Wait a minute, that's my suitcase. I don't care. We're doing it for the good. I'm in charge. Totally. That's what admiralty law is. And that's been established for 6,000 years. The captain is master of his ship.
Okay, now, the other thing is we adopted the courts systems that came through the monarchy that we tried to supposedly separate from, but that didn't really happen, correct?
That's correct. Because our founding fathers created the Novus Ordo Seclorum when they wrote the Constitution, they announced the birth of it, and they put this cancer cell in there in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. Now, notice there was very little need to know that until the 13th Amendment. But after the 13th Amendment, things started happening. This whole country's gone down where everything the government does is legal. They've got the power. And they've had it. They had it all along. But they didn't exercise it until they got us to volunteer to be... Oh, one more thing we didn't mention. Let's go back to the 14th Amendment. It says all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States. Now, wait a minute. That means if you're born in Washington, D.C. or naturalized in Washington, D.C. I've been neither. I was born in Arizona. I've got not even called a birth certificate. It's called something else, but I've got one. Arizona, signed by my doctor in the hospital, everybody else. Mother. So now, what is this naturalized citizen? Arnold Schwarzenegger is the best example I can use. He was born in Austria and therefore became a citizen of Austria. This idea about citizenship is worldwide. So he was born in Austria, and I don't know the terms, but someplace along the line he became an immigrant, but he was permitted. So he could come to America under the terms of some sort of contract he signed, but he would renounce his Austrian citizenship and come to America and go through a process of naturalization. I think you have to wait 5 years, have to have a job or something, and someone to testify they'll keep carry you for, and they'll go on the doles or wherever it is. And then after 5 years, they put you some classes about the Constitution of America, and then they all get together, I think once a year, maybe twice, I don't know when it is. Everybody, they'll show you pictures of everybody raising their right hand with a flag to take an allegiance to become citizens of the, naturalized citizens of the United States. And by the way, Schwarzenegger can't become president either, because he was not born in the United States. But, I don't know that Schwarzenegger knows this, but he can become president because there is no Constitution anymore.
Well,
but he's a naturalized citizen. Now, here's the question. How did you and I become a naturalized citizen? If you were not born in Washington, D.C., but you're a citizen of the United States now, how did you become one? You became a naturalized citizen voluntarily under the 14th Amendment. You walked in and said to the United States government, I want one of those benefits called Socialist Security. Okay, please sign right here. It's a contract. Sign right here. And we did it because we thought there was a law. And if you say, well, I thought there was a law, well, that's your problem, not ours. We've never said it was a law.
Interesting enough, I just got something today in an email of some people that are actually trying to follow up. Where is the presentation for these certificates?
Amelia, cannot hear that question.
I got an email today from some people that are trying to follow up on that birth certificate thing, like where is it presented to and to whom is it presented to get the approval to be able to run for office. And it sounds like it had to go through the parties. And they were finding out that even the parties weren't even following up on that.
Well, that, I don't know that that's true. I don't doubt that. But once again, it doesn't matter. I'm telling you, it doesn't matter.
Well, I realize that, but I just found that was kind of interesting that there are so many angles to the, getting around this issue of, you know, those of us that would try to get a job or anything of that sort, we have to present those documents just about anywhere that has any kind of, you know, requirement for it.
Barack Obama could not play baseball as a boy in Little League because he doesn't have a birth certificate. He doesn't have one. He supplied a certificate of live birth, which is not a birth certificate. So in the Little League in America, you have to bring a birth certificate to play Little League baseball. So he couldn't play.
Isn't that interesting that that would be a requirement to play baseball?
Yes. Apparently so.
Huh.
I guess that's just to confirm your, because, you know, Little League is only like, I'm making this 9 to 11 or something, and then they have advanced Little League or something from 11 to 13, and then 14 and 15 is another league. I don't know how it is. I don't pay attention. But I know that I've been told that you can't play baseball without a birth certificate. And that's probably only to certify that you're at the legal age. Because there are probably young children who are smaller in size that are 15 that could play. Cause they look, you know, 11 or whatever it is. And so they probably say, okay, provide proof that you're 11.
Okay. So now that I changed the subject a little bit there, but you can go back to what you were...
Well, I'm trying to point out that we can elect anyone we jolly well want to. We could elect some guy from Bohemia, wherever that is. Or someone from China. Well, we can elect him, but we want to. I'm told on the 20th we're going to raise the Chinese communist flag in Washington, D.C. That's a good idea.
Right, but actually I heard him come out and say that they were, I think they got a little flack over it and say they weren't. There was some other way they were getting around it.
Well, I wish they had. I'd love to see it. See what the American people would do with that.
Well, isn't the raising of another flag on our ground like admitting we've been conquered?
Well, yeah, that's one of the objects. Well, ambassadors are not held to become responsible. They can drive their cars and break laws and everything else. They try to, you know, obey the laws of the nation, but they're given immunity. There's always they make movies about it. The guys who commit murder, but they're from, you know, Algeria or something, and they're sent back home. So, no doubt that the German consulate in Washington, D.C. is probably German property. They can raise their German flag if they want. But that's, but let's go back. Notice what President Roosevelt said. The international bankers declared us bankrupt. Wait a minute. This is America. You can't do it. You're not an American. No, they own the debt. And they're saying, listen, as we own the debt, we have become the legal owners of this nation. Now, let's just presume that the reason they thought about raising the Chinese flag is to show us that, because it's been reported in emails I'm getting all the time, that China now owns the largest percentage of our national debt.
Yes.
So for in bankruptcy, we're kind of in like receivership?
Yes. And they're running the show.
And we've been in receivership since 1938?
That is the claim of Howard Freeman, and it's mine as well, based upon the story. I can't prove this. All I can do is, does it explain the circumstances? And I think it does.
Well, they act like it.
And maybe that's why the Chinese were going to raise their flag. It was an admission that the Chinese are now in charge. There's a story about 1812. You heard this one about how the Rothschilds took over the Bank of England and the English government? You ever heard
this
story?
Well, go ahead and say it.
It's very brief. Mm-hmm. There was a war of 1812 between England and France. At the same time, they were fighting the war in apparently America. But in 1812 or whenever it was, Napoleon was fighting Cornwallis, I guess it was, in the Battle of Waterloo. And the Rothschilds, who were international bankers who loaned money to nations primarily, would sell government bonds, buy and sell government bonds. That was the way the government raised the money for the war. So the story goes that it's probably, maybe it's just a story. I don't know, but I think it's true. Let's just finish. So the story goes that this was the pivotal battle, that it was the final battle of the war, and if Cornwallis won, England would be safe. If Napoleon won, France was in charge of England. So the bankers knew that the Rothschilds had, because the Rothschilds had central banks in many other nations, had their own courier service. There was no telephone, no telegraph, no, you know, Pony Express, nothing. So they'd have to wait for someone to come from the Cornwallis to let us know what happened in the battle. But they knew, the bankers knew, that the Rothschilds could get through borders with their red pouch. And they certified that they were a part of the Rothschild family, and they could come from France into England with quicker than the government could. So they were sitting there watching Lord Rothschild, who got one of these pouches and read it and started looking very forlorn and despondent and, oh my goodness. So the word flashed through the market, the bond market, oh my gosh, Cornwallis must have lost. Rothschild just learned that. So the word was sell bonds. And when everybody sells bonds at the same time, the price goes down. And for everyone that sold bonds, somebody bought them. One of the things I wondered about when I was in college, when we talked about the crash of 29, we're always talking about those people who are selling the stocks. Who was buying? I wondered about that. I talked about it in the Unseen Hand. I found out. The people that were buying the stocks as the market plummeted were those who got out in 1928, before the crash of 1929. The stock market was high, so they sold slowly in a year, so not to drop the prices. They took all that profit and sat on them until 1933 when it plummeted, and then they started buying stocks.
Okay, that was again by design, and don't ever let it be said that economics is not a part of warfare.
Thank you. The Unseen Hand, if you want to read the whole story, it's all detail. I wrote about it in The Unseen Hand in 1985. In fact, I was teaching it in my classes in economics at a community college in 1973 to 76. So I knew about it. But notice, the international bankers declared... Oh, let me finish the story. So after the war was over, all these bonds were sold. They don't talk about who bought them, but they were being bought by the Rothschilds with other people. In other words, the Rothschilds didn't come back in. So then they found out, after all this tumultuous buying and selling and the thing with reduced bond prices, someone came there directly from Cornwallis and announced to the bond market, "We won! We beat Napoleon." And they looked for the Rothschild. He wasn't there. He was in the counting houses counting his money.
So that's a little bit of the market timing that goes on now, only behind the scenes.
Oh, I'm sure it's the case. I got an article. I talked about this in my Secrets. I think I talked about it in The Unseen Hand as well. The price of gold is not set by the free market. It's set every weekday morning, by five bankers in London, England, one of which is a Rothschild. They're the ones that set the price of gold.
For the world?
Yes. Isn't that interesting? No, it's the market, up and down, buying and selling. No, not for the price of gold. Isn't that interesting?
Well, there's probably more like that than we even realize, too.
I once had a stockbroker call me and say, "It's time to, you ever given any thought to investing in the stock market?" And I said, "Listen, if I want to lose my money, I'll find another way to do it." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "I'll tell you what." He called from Portland. I don't know how he got my name, maybe because I used to live there. He called me and I said, "Listen, I said, where are you located?" He said, "Well, we're on so-and-so street." I said, "Well, that's very close to Burnside." "Oh, yes." I said, "There's a bookstore on Powell called so-and-so, Burnside, which is the major east-west street in Portland." I said, "Go across the street and buy the copy of the book called The Unseen Hand, because I wrote it, and read about how stock markets are controlled by others than the marketplace." I said, read about it. The crash in 1929 was planned in 1907.
And prior ones to that, too.
Yes, exactly. That's a whole other story, another program. Some night we can talk about that if you wish. But that's all covered in the Unseen Hand. But no, go back. Now, if the Chinese own the national debt, that could be the way that this conspiracy was notifying the American people, we don't own our country anymore, the Chinese do. Because they might own the majority of the international debt. What does this debt consist of? Bonds sold by the Treasury Department to the international bankers. The national debt is now $11 trillion and going up. If you divide that by 300 million people, that's $30,000 apiece. We owe them. Oh, that's because all of us have $30,000 worth of bonds. I hate to say this, Melody and Katie, but I don't. Someone's got my share. And I would hazard a guess that they've got your share as well. So there's three of us. That's $90,000 worth of government bonds that someone else owns, but we own this. We own the no, we don't own the national debt. Someone else does.
Okay, now what you're saying here is being done and done on a regular basis in other countries of collapsing their economies. And the interesting part that's taking place with us is, okay, so we think that, okay, if it happens to us, then we'll be able to go back and start build all over again. Yeah. But what I'm seeing in Argentina, as soon as the people started building again, they went back in and collapsed it on them again.
Yes.
So, I mean, once a sucker, always a sucker.
There's a nice way to prove this. It's very simple. Get your dictionary out, your Webster's. Don't use the Black's Law Dictionary. I don't know if it's got damn it, but use Webster's. Look up the word inflation. Inflation, an increase in the quantity of money causing prices to go up. That's it. Nothing about unions or housewives or cost push or demand pull. I learned that all in college. Look at the definition, and I'll give you a simple example. I live in Tucson, about 600,000 people here. Let's say tonight at midnight, while everybody's sleeping or should be sleeping, a helicopter flies over the city, or a couple of them, and they drop millions of American dollars out into circulation. They just push them out of the helicopter. Let's say $1 million. And when we wake up in the morning, boy, we can find the money everywhere. What's that going to do to the prices? Going to raise prices. Why? Because we're all going to go to the store and we can buy now, we can buy that TV set we wanted and we found it on the streets and we can buy that new refrigerator we wanted and prices, once there's only three refrigerators for sale and people start showing them, say, I'll give you the price is $600, I'll give you $1,000, next guy says, I'll give you $1,215, the price is going up. And then if they do it again the next morning, guess what happens? Even higher. The inflation rate in Rhodesia is now measured in millions of what it used to be. You would need millions of whatever, let's call it kopecks, I don't know, millions of kopecks to buy a day. Why? Because the government's flooding the market with paper money. And that's the tool. Now, deflation is a decrease in the money supply causing prices to go down. That's because there's less money, and the guy with the TV sets can't sell them at the regular price, so he gives you a price discount. Says, come in today only. Instead of the $500 for the high definition, it's now $300, and people will come in and buy it at $300. Now, it then behooves you to get control of the money supply. And then you can increase it and decrease it, and then increase it and decrease it, and cause waves anytime you want to. And when you learn from the private reserve, by the way, it's not federal, it's privately owned, the private reserve admits they control the volume of money.
Isn't there a Rothschild statement to the fact that...
That charge has been made. I can't find it in my research. It doesn't really matter. All we know is that the private reserve is private. It's not federal. And that's very easy to prove as well. All you got to do is go to a library. It's got phone books. And find a city phone book that's Dallas or San Francisco. There's like, I think, 10 or 12 regional banks of the private reserve. and you find the one that, let's say Dallas, you got a Dallas phone book, and say, okay, I'll look in the blue pages where all the government listings are because I want to call the private reserve in Dallas. And you look and look, and it's not listed under the Department of Treasury, under F's for federal. It's not listed under the IRS or Social Security. It's not listed. Why? But you go to the white pages, and there's Federal Express. Well, that's not federal. It's owned by stockholders. And underneath there is Federal Reserve. Now, wait a minute. Why is it listed in the white pages? Because it's privately owned. It's not federal. When they send things out in the mail, they got to pay postage. Your congressman doesn't do that. Because he's federal. So you can prove it very easily. It's not federally owned. And Ron Paul's been trying to get the thing audited for years. They finally got some votes now. Maybe they'll get it audited.
Well, even if they do get that, my question is, they had problems with that before they ever had, with the bankers, ever before they ever had the Federal Reserve anyway.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
And they've been deceitful and and doing all their other shenanigans, you know, yes, before that.
Let me tell you this. The American Revolution, the War of 1812, and the Civil War were all fought over the issue of a central bank. All three of them. Which means they tried to get the government to create a privately owned central bank, and America wouldn't do it. So even the Civil War was fought over that. That's all covered in my Unseen Hand as well.
And they were, I mean, that was a major thing when they formed this country, and now we're handing it over to them.
Yes. Well, there were three banks, or two privately owned banks of the United States created after the American Revolution, after the War of 1812, but they both had a 20-year charter, and they were not passed on, they were not renewed. So they planned the Civil War. International bankers planned the Civil War. It's a matter of proof. And that's all covered by the Unseen Hand. This unknown author in Arizona figured it out, put it in writing, called The Unseen Hand. The book's still being sold 25 years later.
And you've not even had to revise it or anything like
nope.
that?
By the way, I just got notice a week ago that book and the New World Order book are going to be published by a private publishing company in China. Communist China is going to allow this book publisher to publish my two books.
Wow.
I'm staggered by that. And five foreign nations in Europe are publishing the book in their native language. And I did nothing to solicit those. Publishers called me. People around the world want to know what this conspiracy theory is.
So, in order to summate what, you know, because you got a little bit into the Masons' involvement, and then you get into the bankers and all the other hands involved in the predicted failure of this country. What is your summation on this?
Well, you made a comment about the Unseen Hand, the bibliography in the back and the footnotes. It took a long time. It's not something you just discovered because you had to dig it out. That's what I've done. It's like putting a puzzle together. And that's what I've had to do, and others have done it as well. We're not through yet. We're still looking and finding additional material out. It's getting scary. This country is in very serious trouble right now.
Right.
And what would you recommend for us to get us out of trouble?
The only thing that a moral people can do in a crisis like this is education, not political action. That doesn't work because both parties are controlled by the same people as told to us on national television by Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton said that with his own mouth in 1992. Both parties are controlled by the same people. Bill Clinton said that. Bill Clinton. Am I making that up? Nope. Huh?
In 1992?
Yes, ma'am. I've got a video out called Clinton's Conspiracy. I got a booklet out. I've had it out for 20 years, probably. Well, whatever, 1992, that's what, 17 years. I came out with it probably, well, it was 1992. I came out with it just a short time later, maybe in 1995.
you know, the other thing is that, might add, is that holding people accountable for their actions might be one process, not having a, you know, a dualistic way of doing things. I mean, because here we are handing it over to the very guys that took it. That needs to stop. It just doesn't work because they're going to be back again.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
Well, so. I've been saying this since I got involved with partisan politics back in the 60s. As a Goldwater volunteer, I said, here's the answer. And this is what, if you're in the party politics, here's what you should do for your local your party. Here's what you do. You get together with all your other Republicans, however you want to decide, to, you know, but write a platform. And then you go out and you find a person who will sign a contract to abide by the principles on the contract. Okay? He signs it. Then he's elected. Let's say he's elected. You're fortunate. You get him elected. And then the first thing he does, the first vote he takes is he votes yes on a tax increase. And in the platform, he promised not to vote for tax increases. You don't have to wait for 2 years. You don't have to recall him. You take the contract to a judge and say, Your Honor, Congressman Jones signed this contract. It's been notarized, witnessed. Here it is. Read it. Provision number 47 says he shall not vote for a tax increase. On January, whatever it is, or June 15th, he voted for a tax increase. We want him removed from office, and it will happen within hours of that. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
That's the answer. No, we don't do that. We, people in the party, run around and create platforms and write them down, and then the guy says, I'll work on that platform, and then it doesn't do it at all. It doesn't matter.
Well, we need to bring it to an end here, and I just, is there any, you know, further things that you'd like to finish for the summit?
I would just say this. You've been very kind, both of you, for letting me talk about this stuff. I know it's scary and everything else, but look at it. I'm trying to cover the facts. Go to my website. These videos are mentioned there. They're reasonably priced. These books are reasonably priced. Ralph-Epperson.com. Go there, browse, and read, and please start getting educated. That's the only answer.
Well, I want to thank you, Katie, and Ralph,
and thank you, Ralph. This has been a very interesting couple of hours. Thank you.
Well, thank you so very much. Both of you are very kind.
Well, thank you, and hope to have you back again.
Okay, you're very kind.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
Good night.